Happy birthday! Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and merry assorted other holidays. This is the 80 Page Cast, and I'm Jingle Bell Rob London.
Deck the halls with bows of me, I'm David Henyon.
I can't believe that you acknowledged other holidays. That's like a war on Christmas! You're
well, he's Canadian, so
and I'm
it's
Farahan, by the way. Hello.
I'm Canadian. I sent out a Hanukkah card this very week. After looking on the calendar to see when Hanukkah was.
You monster. You monster. I'm Australian. We invented the frickin' war on Christmas, son. You.
Well, yeah,
are
you have
monster.
A stupid Murdoch crazy bastard.
Wait. Yes, it is a Rupert Murdoch invention, yes.
Oh, I thought you meant, like, Howling Mad Murdoch. And I was confusing him with, Mel Gibson's character from Lethal Weapon for some reason. And of course, Mel Gibson is Australian. And the first Lethal Weapon takes place at Christmas.
Anyway, comic books.
Yes. So, welcome to our special holiday episode. We're recording a day early due to the wassailing I'll be doing tomorrow.
I don't know what
as soon
means.
As I look up what wassailing is.
Oh.
I hear some jingle bells. I've got a mug of nog here.
I have the Punisher holiday special in front of me from 1992. Oh,
that sounds awesomely festive.
It has holofoil on the cover.
Ooh. Is it like red and green holofoil?
It is red, yes.
And I'm guessing over under number of stories in that issue where he has to kill criminals dressed as Santa Claus, I'm guessing there are at least two.
No, he doesn't dress as Santa Claus to kill
people. Does he have to kill criminals who are dressed as Santa Claus?
He does not.
That is shocking.
Oh, he does not. He does use a Santa Claus display to impale a dude, though.
Well, that's something.
That counts.
Like, it's Santa's sleigh and then all the reindeer, and he impales somebody using Rudolph.
You might call it Santa's sleigh.
You yes. might, yes. No, it's truly terrible. I won't be covering this one on the website because I'm going to be – I want to do five from different publishers.
Okay.
But it's kind of awful. Christmas comics are amazing.
It's a Punisher comic from the 90s. There's a very good chance it's going to be awful.
So what's the news?
All right, well, before we get into the festivities, I think we'll discuss a little news. First off, it's another high-profile costume design, as Jessica Drew, the first Spider-Woman, is receiving what is basically her first new costume in 40 years. And it's quite a departure from her original. So instead of the red and yellow tights, which not so subtly outline her erogenous zones, it's a jacket, there are some sort of goggly sunglasses, but she still has her armpit webs.
Which is weird.
Well, unlike Spider-Man's, hers are actually functional, and she can, like, glide with them.
Okay. That's weird. Yeah, the design's okay. They've been updating a lot of costumes lately. It's, I guess, one of the better ones.
I like it.
Although,
I think
it reminds me of kind of like the simplified Hawkeye Kate.
Kate Bishop.
Kate Bishop. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of her outfit with sleeves.
Yeah, I can kind of see that.
And red instead of purple.
It's a thing, though. Like, I mean, it's not going to last, and it's not going to capture anybody. It's not going to be like an iconic look for the character. But, the original costume, for all that it's touted now to be sexist, is actually a really striking looking costume. Like it definitely stands out.
Yeah, it kind of needs pants, but aside from that,
pants. She doesn't have
pants. Well,
a different color, like a pant design that looks like pants, not the showy.
And my thing was, it just never looked very spidery.
No,
that's true. Unlike the red and blue other guy, he's always so spidery.
He's got webs all over him.
Ah, well then.
Yeah, but the basic design.
And a spider on his chest and back, and also he's like big creepy eyes.
Now, speaking of big creepy eyes, the glasses that look like her mask, that's kind of...
By that logic, she's designed to look like the pattern of a Black Widow spider on the back of a Black Widow spider across her body. Plus, she has webs underneath her arms.
Yeah.
Except she's red and yellow.
And she has... And
there's already a black widow.
Black widow, yeah. There's that.
Red and yellow. Oh well.
It's an okay costume. It will not last because most new redesign costumes don't last except for like the new Captain Marvel. Because her costume is awesome.
And I think for the function that the direction they're trying to take the character in, I think it works better. They're trying to sort of emphasize her past as a private detective. And it is hard to do a lot of detecting in red and yellow.
Yeah, it's hard to ground her in bright red spandex.
It will all depend on what happens if she appears in a movie, too. I mean, like, if she appears in a movie and she gets an iconic look on screen, because she's pretty much an unknown character.
Well, yeah, this kind of does feel like a redesign for, like, she's going to show up one of the Netflix TV shows.
I can see, assuming that they can legally use her in that.
Yeah. Well, they could probably use her, they just can't call her Spider-Woman, I would guess.
Why?
Well, that might be tied in with the Spider-Man rights, even though she's never been particularly associated with Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I don't know. That would be a really interesting question. I would assume not. Because there is a precedent for licensing her in other media completely separate of Spider-Man, so...
Yes, but it's like if Marvel didn't have the rights to Hulk and was making a She-Hulk movie.
It's not the same as doing Jessica Carpenter, who is decidedly a same costume version as a Spider-Man. Like, she's got a completely different look, completely different powers. She just has a name that is similar. I don't know. It would be interesting to see.
And it might even be something like Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch, where they can both use it.
Yeah, I would really doubt if her rights were at all tied up with Spider-Man's.
Of course, speaking of the Spider-Man rights, that brings us to our next discussion, which is I think we've all heard about the Sony leaks, as caused by either malicious domestic hackers or by sinister agents of the North Korean government.
Although probably a little bit of both.
A little bit of both. But the upshot of it is, it turns out that it looked like Sony had no idea what to do with Spider-Man, and it turns out that, yes, that is actually correct.
Well, we could already guess that. They were making a Sinister Six movie without a Spider-Man in it.
Yes. Or without having introduced the Sinister Six yet.
You could do that, but it's just weird.
So tell us some more details about this.
Well, it turns out that Sony was so desperate to find something to do with their Spider-Man rights, they kind of considered letting somebody else do it. And by somebody else, I mean Marvel. As apparently discussions have occurred between Sony and Marvel/Disney to allow Spider-Man to appear in that upcoming Captain America Civil War movie.
Oh, so the rumors were not just rumors.
No.
Ah.
And this apparently still might happen, although apparently differences have arisen as to how much creative control each side gets.
Marvel gets as much as they want.
Well, they would like that. And apparently they would also like to start over and ditch Andrew Garfield.
I kind of like Garfield, but yeah, they really should start
over. I think Garfield's a good Spider-Man. I'm not sold on his Peter Parker.
Which is still one better than Tobey Maguire.
Well, no, I thought Tobey Maguire was a good Peter Parker. I just don't think he was a good Spider-Man.
He was an uneven Peter for me.
I mean, he was convincingly...
He was a bad Spider-Man.
He was a convincingly lame as Peter Parker.
Yes.
Like, I can believe why, you know, people don't want to be around this sweaty, mouth-breathing nerd.
But I mean, be fair to Andrew Garfield, Peter Parker was only lame for a very small period of his comic. I mean, the Peter Parker you have once Steve Ditko leaves and Peter's in college, drawn by John Romita, is not the nerdy, wimpy kid he was.
This is entirely true.
Steve Ditko was drawing him. Andrew Garfield captures that Peter perfectly well, I think. The later Peter, they're just applying that. I mean, the Peter Parker who's an author or who was featured during the 80s had a lot of problems in his life, but he wasn't uncool. He wasn't the nerdy kid he was back in high school.
No.
And they just applied basically that version of Peter to his high school years. And there's a sense of him being a bit of an outcast, but it wasn't a big thing with these movies, and I was fine with that. I was fine with that. He wasn't what you would normally expect from high school Peter. He was a lot cooler.
Yes.
With his skateboard and his
awesome hair.
Yeah, his awesome hair. The idea of jettisoning Andrew Garfield is clearly a power play. It's not. Yeah. It has nothing to do with his position as an actor and what he brings to the table. It is entirely a power play. It's entirely saying, no, we have an established world and we don't want our established world to be your established world. If you get rid of Andrew Garfield, you nix all of the continuity they've established with these two movies. Even if you reference it, it's gone, you know?
Right.
So it's clearly a power play, and that's clearly why Sony's like, no.
Although apparently they're still talking about it.
Well, of course, because they don't know what to do, because Marvel makes bank.
Yeah.
Have the profits of these two Spider-Man movies compared well to the original Spider-Man movies? Do you not?
They've made less than any of them, even Spider-Man 3, which nobody kind of liked.
Yeah. And is that less before adjustments for inflation, or is that less?
It's less both.
Less period.
Yeah.
So Sony have tasted how much money you can make from Spider-Man, but clearly they're not doing that anymore. So, it's a tricky thing. And if Spider-Man goes back to Marvel and Marvel get the rights, that movie will immediately be a billion-dollar movie. Like, it doesn't matter even what quality it is. It will immediately be a billion-dollar movie.
I would openly weep tears of joy.
Yeah.
Apparently, other Sony proposals included making a movie out of Kraven's Last Hunt.
Admittedly, it would be a good movie.
I like Kraven's Last Hunt a lot, but I don't think it works as your first Spider-Man movie.
Or the first thing Kraven does.
No. The thing with Kraven is that he was driven crazy by years of humiliations and, you know, stewing in hatred. You can't have the first thing he does be shooting Spider-Man, burying him alive, and then stealing his clothes.
Well, if you imply an extended back history and flashbacks in the movie, but you're right, you can't do it as your first Spider-Man movie. There has to be at least the second.
But I mean, the reason the comic has so much impact is because you have, how many, was it 20, 30 years of history already?
Right.
By the time you do it? Yeah, 20 years, yeah.
And Kraven had been around for most of them.
Yes, And so you have this really established Spider-Man and a really established Kraven. And by the time you get that far, Kraven has this really strong image in fans' eyes. And partly he was a well-liked villain, but he was also regarded as kind of a silly part of Spider-Man's rogues gallery.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, he dresses like a wears a lion face
as a fist.
Yeah, yeah. So when you take this guy who is well known and popular, but also ridiculous, and make him shoot and bury Spider-Man, that has a fucking shitload of impact. There's no way you can replicate that kind of impact on a movie. And it's one of the problems the Spider-Man movies keep butting up against. It's like, okay, so you kill Gwen in your second movie, but you just killed her because you know they killed her in the comics, not because it fed your story. Yeah. Like, she didn't need to die. Like, it didn't really have much impact. It wasn't...
Not really, no.
It wasn't a moment where you're like, oh my god, they killed Gwen. That is so bold. I was not expecting that. No, it's more like, oh, okay. That's when they kill her. Fair enough.
I mean, it did sting a little just because Emma Stone is so likable and she's kind of the best part of those movies.
Yeah,
she is really likable and her chemistry with Andrew Garfield is amazing. But that's why you don't kill her. Like,
yes. Yeah, that was the one thing that was working, guys.
It's amazing how even when the Marvel movies have flaws, and they always have flaws. Like yeah. the first Cap movie has some really deep flaws in the plotting. Even when they're flawed movies, like that one, they hit the tone perfectly and they capture the characters exactly how you want them to be. So even though the plot of Cap is kind of inevitable, like, you know, he has to get frozen. So some really silly shit happens at the end. it doesn't matter because for the entire ride, you're in Cap's world in a way you want to be. Whereas with the Sony Spider-Man movies, it's so apparent on the screen that they're not quite sure what they're doing. So you have radical shifts in tone with Electro as a character. Just ridiculous whiplash in how the tone shifts with Electro as a character. There's nothing like that in the Captain America movies or in the Iron Man movies. I mean, as bad as Iron Man 2 might get, it's nothing as unfocused as these Spider-Man films. So it's not surprising to find out that the reason they're unfocused is because Sony doesn't have a clue what they're bloody doing.
Yeah, so let's hope that they can come to some sort of agreement and that Marvel retains creative control over everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you don't... Honestly, it's such a ridiculous situation. Like, it is such a ridiculous situation. Because, I mean, if we're talking what the fans want is for Sony to fuck off.
Yeah. We just want Spider-Man in a Marvel movie.
You know, and we want goddamn Fantastic Four back as well.
Yeah.
Is it Paramount?
Fox.
Fox, give us back our Fantastic Four, god damn it. But hopefully that'll happen when the thing flops like crazy, but yeah. It's I don't care about X-Men. I'm actually kind of glad.
They're doing okay with X-Men. It's okay.
Yeah. X-Men works in its own little
world. Yeah, I'm kind of glad that X-Men... There's
some X-Men characters in Avenger movies, but...
A ghettoed off.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't mind Beast to be around, but I don't really need any other X-Men characters. I'm not missing some sparkling scene between Scott Summers and Captain America, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. They measure the size of these sticks in their respective asses.
Cap's like, I have an excuse. I'm from the 1940s.
Hey, I have an excuse. I was raised by an insane Victorian scientist in an evil orphanage. Whoa, whoa. Spare me your life story. All right. And in other news, new solicitations came out, which means cancellations.
Oh.
Over at Marvel, I'm afraid to say that Ghost Rider is ending.
Kind of knew it was going to happen eventually.
As is Nightcrawler.
Oh, so I guess they're letting Chris Claremont write something else instead.
Probably, yes. And my understanding is that they pay him anyway. Like, he's on, like, a lifelong retainer.
So you might as well get him writing something. What do you want to write now, Chris?
Garrock the Petrified Man? Okay, get him an artist. over at DC, the cancellations are somewhat more extensive. Ending are Aquaman and the Others. Surprise. And a spinoff of Aquaman is ending.
Plus, it's a terrible title for anything. Aquaman and the Others.
They might as well just call it Aquaman and the Rest. Aquaman, which case, I guess the rest would be the Professor and Marianne.
Aquaman and some dudes.
Arkham Manor, which I guess turned out to just be a miniseries.
Oh, huh.
Batwoman.
Yeah, that's really short. Oh, I thought that was supposed to be good.
Well, remember, it lost its original creative team when they wouldn't let her get married.
Oh, yeah.
And it became a whole thing.
Yeah.
No, Batwoman's had several shifts in creative teams because they haven't been able to work out what to do with her because they didn't let Gail Simone do what she wanted.
No, it was, who was that? Hayden Blackman.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Yeah, Gail Simone was Batgirl.
Right. Oh, Batgirl. Okay. Oh, confusing the two.
Yeah.
Infinity Man and the Forever People, which I did not realize actually had their own series.
What? Okay. Sure.
It's one of the New Gods series.
I know what they are. I didn't know they had a book.
It's the one that nobody likes.
Apparently.
See, that's why it's gotten canceled, is because douches like you didn't know it existed.
Ugh. Even if I knew it existed, I mean, I have some fondness for the other, fourth world concepts. You know, people like Orion and they like Mr. Miracle. Nobody likes the Forever People.
Shut up.
Come on. Do you like the Forever People?
Yes.
Yes, he does.
Really?
Of course he does. Of course I like the Forever People.
Wait, yeah. Are they the ones that have the flying car motorcycle
thing?
Right,
they're like kind of hippies and they merge into one Captain Planet dude.
I at least love them in concept. I don't know about
Red. They are the best space hippies I've ever seen.
Well, I mean, and I guess that's true. That's because the only other space hippies I know are from one episode of Star Trek. You're glad when they all get poisoned at the end, because they're terrible space hippies. The whole Enterprise probably smelled like patchouli for a week.
Got rid of the Tremble smell.
Speaking of series I didn't know were still going, Clarion the Witch Boy.
Yeah, didn't that just start?
I think so, also, but then they remembered, oh, right, they're publishing a book about Clarion the Witch Boy.
Yeah, on his own, no. Maybe if you team him with, like, their Frankenstein or something?
I know him solely from that one episode of Batman.
I know him from the episode of the, Young Justice.
Oh, I didn't know he was on that.
I think he was, or I'm remembering the wrong show.
Also ending Trinity of Sin.
Okay, what? Is this an original Sin tie-in in the wrong company?
Sadly, no. It was, I think it was The Question. Maybe The Phantom Stranger was in there.
Oh, and somebody else.
Oh, Pandora, I want to say.
Oh, yeah, when they started that Pandora.
Right, it was the whole thing. Yeah.
Can't remember that.
Also, a bunch of stuff, and a Swamp Thing, which I guess is losing its writer to a Marvel exclusive.
They're getting rid of Swamp Thing? I thought that was one of their better books.
I mean, also ending a bunch of books that are probably going to be relaunched, like Green Lantern Corps, Green Lantern. Actually, all the Green Lantern books are ending. Green Lantern Corps, Green Lantern, New Guardians, and Red Lanterns.
Too many lanterns.
Also ending is Star Spangled War Stories, which, again...
Again, it's still around this long? Wow.
I didn't even know surprising. It was around in the first place.
Well, wait, wasn't that... Was that one of their launch titles?
Yeah, I think that was one of their launch titles, wasn't it?
No, they had a couple of war comics as their launch titles. Those were canceled ages ago.
So they brought a new one.
I just remember seeing a cover with a G.I. Zombie on it.
Was this an excuse to give one of the Q-Berts work? Or not Q-Berts?
Could have been the Q-Bert work out. I know that one of the Q-Berts is currently employed by Marvel. I think the other Q-Bert might be with DC.
Ooh.
And obviously Joe is deceased.
Oh wait, no, isn't one of the Q-Berts drawing Superman or something?
No, you're thinking of Romita. Yeah.
I was thinking of Romita. Yeah. I should know the Q-Berts better. I used to live near their school.
Yeah, well, one of the Q-Berts is drawing Axis.
Oh, okay, that was the big thing.
I think it's Andy. I cannot keep my Q-Bert straight. And then there's also Katie Q-Bert, who is now an editor with Marvel.
Oh.
I believe she is a granddaughter of Joe. But she's not the daughter of either Adam or Andy.
Oh, he has more kids.
Yes.
Okay.
The Q-Berts are a prolific brood.
Hmm.
Almost as much, or I guess a little more than the Buscemas, who have three people in the comics industry.
Steve Buscema managed to get away.
Okay, and I guess that brings us to our couple final news items. One, DC has found its Amanda Waller, and it is not Oprah.
Yay!
It is critically acclaimed actress Viola Davis, who currently appears on the TV show How to Get Away with Murder.
Yay. I never heard of that show, but...
She's a good actress.
Looking at her, she's been in things. I can't remember.
She was at least nominated for an Oscar. I'm not sure if she won, but she's good. And I guess Intrigue will be filming the movie around her TV show.
Hmm.
Hopefully she'll be able to bring the badass.
Yeah, I mean,
She's a bit thin.
She is at least middle-aged.
Yeah, she's nice age. She's short. She looks like she can yell at people.
Yelling.
I know I've seen her in something, but I can't remember what. All
right. And
you're checking it on the internet.
Yes, of course I'm checking it on the
internet. And our final news item, the reboots have been a thing in the comics industry, but one publisher has... resisted up to this point. That is Archie Comics, and they resist no more. Coming soon is Archie Number One by Mark Waid and Saga artist Fiona Staples.
Oh. Wait, Saga's ending, or is she just getting...
She's just taking a couple months off, I guess, to do Archie.
Oh.
It will apparently delve into the... It will feature a more modern style, and will delve into the origins of the Archie... Veronica Betty love triangle.
So they're achieving basically what they've achieved already on Afterlife with Archie this issue.
Yes, but presumably with less, rampant murder.
Maybe.
There's a lot of murder in Afterlife with Archie.
And apparently this will have an edgier style of humor. The sort of Archie House style will continue in the digests. As they're apparently relaunching their entire line after this.
Oh, okay.
So
are they trying to reboot Archie continuity when Archie doesn't really have continuity?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, maybe it'll have tighter continuity now, and then they can have, like, events.
Well, they have continuity. It's just, it's not very far reaching. Like it, I guess, weird. Just weird.
So is like Jughead's Diner still in continuity?
I hope so. Jughead's Diner is the frickin' bomb.
For the uninitiated, Jughead's Diner is the comic about? Andrew, I think you better explain it.
Well, it's about the time that Jughead was coming home from Riverdale and he was hungry. Coming home to Riverdale and he was hungry. And so he stopped off at a 1950s diner, and it was an abandoned diner, and he was sitting on the chair, and he fell off the chair, and he kind of got transported into another dimension, which... in which he...
I thought it was a dream sequence.
He was living in Dinerville, which...
Dinerville.
Which is a land dominated by 1950s diners. That,
I never knew Riverdale was in New Jersey. Huh.
Which are getting bought out by a horrible burger conglomerate, and Jughead helps to run this surreal diner to stop the burger conglomerate from taking it over.
To have them all self-owned by lots of nice Greek diner owners.
No. It was completely surreal, off the wall humor. There's nothing resembling reality in it.
Well, it's Jughead, so yeah, that kind of goes without saying.
Jughead, the best. He was a time cop once.
Like Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Like Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Did he shove two versions of Mr. Weatherby into each other? And they like merged into a giant tumor?
No, he dated Archie Andrews' descendant from the future.
That is unsettling.
It is.
Ew.
It is slightly unsettling.
That's pandering to a very specific demographic of the fandom. It's like two guys.
I believe the name for that ship is Jarchy. And one final news item, which I totally forgot until now, Jerry Conway is returning not only to Marvel, but to Spider-Man, where he largely made his bones.
So they giving him a new series or a slot taking a break?
Slot is kind of taking a break. Spider-Man has been twice monthly for the past little while.
Yeah.
And so it'll be going sort... It'll still continue with its monthly schedule. It's bi-monthly schedule, but one issue will be written by Slott and one will be written by Jerry Conway. And they'll alternate, but it'll be two separate storylines. But Conway was, of course, the first long-term writer to take over Spider-Man after Stan Lee and wrote the original Clone Saga, the death of Gwen Stacy, created Hammerhead, Tombstone, the Jackal. And he hasn't done a lot of comics work since leaving Marvel in the early 90s. He wrote a lot of Law and Orders.
Oh.
Which is why you will occasionally tune into Law and Order and the murderer will be named John Byrne. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. I really like Jerry Conway. He's doing a sort of street-level crime-focused storyline. And by street-level crime, I mean... Like, it's a Marvel gang war, so you've got, like, the Circus of Crime in there.
Oh, so the Circus, not the Magia who are currently run by the Shocker.
No, although Hammerhead's going to be in it.
That's a very interesting level of street.
Well, I mean, you know, they're not, like, the kind of guys, you know, they're, like, bank-robbing level of crime. As opposed to, you know, the current story in Spider-Man, which involves the potential destruction of the multiverse.
Yeah, which it seems too big for Spider-Man, but I guess maybe we'll get to that later.
Well, it's too big for Spider-Man, but maybe not too big for Spider-Man.
It still seems weird.
And I think that
Spider-Man fighting a god is just bizarre.
Well, he's not really a god. He's just like a...
He claims he's a god. He's acting like a god.
Well, you know, it's like what Ernie Hudson says. If somebody asks you if you're a god, you say yes.
Oh, okay, that's better if I pretend that the big bad is Dan Aykroyd.
Well, we know that that's not it, because obviously, you know, Dan Aykroyd is the criminal mastermind Dr. Detroit.
Oh, my goodness.
And now I've suddenly come up with the worst what-if ever for Superior Spider-Man.
No.
where Spider-Man retires from superheroics and just starts promoting vodka that comes in crystal skulls.
No, crystal spiders.
Or it's like a spider skull.
No, a spider with a skull on the back. A sculpture.
Anyway, I think that pretty much does it for the news, as we are now talking about Dan Aykroyd.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir. And folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny little tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight.
And I think we will now move on to what we read this week. So what did we read this week?
Mostly I read comics based on Christmas this week.
Christmas. Okay. So please, so enlighten
old, us. Old vintagey comics based on Christmas. Well, mostly I don't want to talk about them too much, but because we'll do that for the topic. But the I'm going to look and see if I can find anything. Have we talked about Drift Empire of Stone yet?
I don't think we have much. We could talk about it.
We could talk, because I'm not reading.
It's not awful.
It's probably better than the last Drift miniseries.
I've only got the first issue, and it's really good. I'm really enjoying it.
I really like the art.
The art's pretty good, but what I like is that it's basically Drift versus Transformers Victory.
Oh, well, and Transformers Robots in Disguise, the first one.
Oh, wait. Skybite's there?
No,
wait, who's drawing it?
The Megatron. It's Guido is drawing it.
Oh, Guido.
And they call him Gigatron, but he's the Megatron from Robots in Disguise, except, you know, less hilariously incompetent.
The big purplish, blackish dragon dude thing.
Yeah. But like,
it turns into a hand.
Most of the first issue is Drift and Ratchet, which is a great buddy cop duo, I think. Fighting generics from Transformers Victory.
Yes.
Like, just guys who randomly showed up in the background in Transformers Victory or showed up in the first episode to get killed by Star Saber are now fighting Drift, which I think is a brilliant extension of his concept as a character. It's a really cool way to do it. I'm approving of it.
And I kind of like that it's just like a straightforward Transformers adventure, which I like the other Transformers books we're getting, but none of them are really that.
Yes.
You know, we've got More Than Meets the Eye, which is kind of, you know, a weird character thing. And I like Ratchet. You know, what is now Transformers, we've got a lot of, you know, human intrigue and other kinds of intrigue. And then Transformers G.I. Joe is an insane head trip.
It's a man slowly going insane.
So this is just kind of an issue where, you know, the Autobots wage their battles to destroy the evil forces of the Decepticons. And I dig that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to set the world on fire or anything, but it's a good little comic, so I'm pleased with it.
Yeah.
In fact, if it did set the world on fire, that would scare the shit out of me.
Yes, that would be terrible. It would be like Revenge of the Sith. Love hits everywhere.
That's a horrible turn of phrase. I can't believe that ever entered our lexicon.
I don't want to set the world on fire.
That's not a Christmas song.
It is a song, though. And you could set the world on fire if you don't properly maintain your Yule log.
What's a Yule log?
It's a log that you burn at Christmas, I think.
I'm kidding. But only just.
I mean, I figured since, you know, you don't have to burn fires at Christmas because it's summer there.
It is summer.
So you might not be familiar with our Yule log tradition. Or, you know, our sleigh rides.
It's ridiculously hot. I accidentally left the butter out yesterday, and when we came to look at the butter, it was basically butter soup.
Tasty. I think that's a traditional Australian Christmas dish.
Yeah. It is very hot.
It is ball-chillingly cold here right now.
Yeah.
I don't think it ever gets ball-chillingly cold here.
Probably not.
Unless I turn up the aircon really high. Oh no, Australia gets ball-chillingly cold. It's just which parts of it.
Yeah. All right. So this past week, I want to talk a little bit about something I wrote, not necessarily something that I read. This week we had the first printed Marvel handbook in quite some time, the Avengers Now handbook, and I hope you all picked it up. And if not, I will find you.
I got one. I couldn't find some.
That's good. That means I don't have to find you.
Well, fortunately, I live on a different continent, so I feel safe.
Hey, I have a particular set of skills.
Yes, writing and they're all involved with writing the handbook.
Well, that's, you know, research. You can find somebody's address that way. Anyway, it came out pretty well, except for a post-production change, which resulted in a caption referring to Iron Man, referring instead to Ron Man.
What page?
I'm not telling you.
Of course not.
Does that now become continuity?
Yes. Now Iron Man has all the powers and abilities of Ron Burgundy. And, you know, he is a man who enjoys, fine glass of scotch, leather-bound books, and who may or may not believe that San Diego is Spanish for a whale's vagina.
Oh, there he is, Ron Man. Yeah.
Yeah,
Ron Man. But he's called himself now, he's white.
What page? Well,
not that far in, like, when it starts the Avengers Update Index.
Yeah.
Right next to a picture of the new, white, shiny iPod version of Iron Man, he's Ron Man.
He's the superior Iron Man, or the superior...
Like, no, that's not a mistake. That's a subtle reference to Rom Space Knight coming back. He's just called a Ron Space Knight.
Ron Space Knight.
That's how they're getting around the trademark.
Oh my goodness.
But as far as stuff I read this week, I deviated from the Marvel DC paradigm a little to... pick up the Flash Gordon comic holiday special from Dynamite.
Ah,
nice.
Yeah.
How is it?
It's quite good. It's three stories. The authors, in fact, are the reason I picked it up. I'm a big fan of a podcast called The Flophouse, in which Dan McCoy, Elliot Kalin, and Stuart Wellington kind of discuss bad movies, but mostly kind of make a bunch of inside jokes, sing improvised songs, and kind of irritate each other.
Okay.
Elliot Kalin, in fact, I'm going to discuss one of his books a little later, is now the head writer of The Daily Show. Dan McCoy also writes for The Daily Show, and Stuart Wellington is a bartender. But he's very funny. But anyway, they were all hired to write a story each for this, and I quite enjoyed all three.
Really?
Surprisingly, I think I enjoyed Dan McCoy's story. Dan is sort of the frequently referred to as the Leonardo of the podcast, as he is kind of the leader and lacks the strong personality traits of the other two. But his story is really good.
Oh, what is that story about?
It's about a Christmas-like celebration on the planet, I think it's Arborea. It's the one that Timothy Dalton's the king of.
Yes, the Robin Hood guys.
Yeah, the Robin Hood guys. Except here it's a bunch of animal guys for some reason.
Well, there are lots of animal guys mixed in with that.
I mean, I know very little about Flash Gordon. I've seen the 80s movie and I watched the 90s cartoon.
Yeah, I've seen the animated movie. Well, it's a weird thing where either there's like only like three kinds of animal men, or there's three kinds of animal men that mix together to make a bunch of different.
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of animal people on this. There's there are rhino people and like deer people. There's an amusing sight gag with a reindeer person.
There's the point is that he has a
a lion friend.
No shit.
And then I think the guy supposed to be the Timothy Dalton guy is like a bald blue guy.
Oh, bald blue.
Anyway, that's the Dan McCoy story. The Elliot Kalin story is about one of Ming's minions, who is a pig man, who has ended up in Belarus and befriends a Jewish family at Hanukkah.
Oh.
It's quite good. And then the Stuart Wellington story is the shortest of the three, and I think probably the least of the three, but it's still pretty good. It's about Dale Arden not enjoying the holidays and also fighting like a giant robot crab. So I enjoyed it. It's got three tales of Christmas cheer, and I quite enjoyed it.
Oh, nice. That's a shame I didn't actually see that. I was tempted to get that.
And in other Elliot Kalin news, I also picked up the first issue of Spider-Man and the X-Men, which is also written by Elliot Kalin, by himself this time.
Oh, all by his little self.
And he is a wee man. Maybe just a bit. Also Wolverine is dead, and he needs somebody new to teach at the Jean Grey school, so he gets Spider-Man, who is also there with the dual mission of finding a traitor amongst the ex-students.
Yeah, a small select group of the ex-students.
Yes, basically a class of weirdos. You got your Glob Herman and your Hellion. And
Shark Girl, Rock Slide.
Yeah, Rock Slide.
Hi, boy.
There's Brain, and there's a girl whose only superpower seems to be Progeria.
Yeah. Named Ernst.
Ernst? Yeah, I'm not sure what her deal is.
Yeah, she's new to me. I sort of vaguely know at least the others. Yeah. Well, maybe not Hellion so much.
Yeah. But anyway, so Spider-Man is perhaps not widely accepted amongst the X-Men, who it turns out aren't super crazy about it.
Yeah, Storm seems to really, really hate him.
I mean, that kind of makes sense because they're not people who have anything in common.
Yeah, no,
that's
I guess they
because the X-Men are super racist against non-mutants.
I mean, the Beast likes him okay, and obviously Wolverine hired him.
Yeah, hired him via napkin.
Yes, like it was like in his last will, that Spider-Man be given this terrible job.
Yes, well, I'll scroll on the napkin.
Oh, what an asshole move.
Well, he's Wolverine. It's like his final revenge. Anyway, this whole thing leads to a field trip, and that, of course, leads to dinosaurs, and dinosaurs leads to a surprisingly first time ever teaming up of Stegron the Dinosaur Man and Sauron.
Which seems ridiculous. That how long have these guys been around?
Since the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and they've never teamed up before?
Surprisingly not. I mean, I guess Sauron is technically not a dinosaur. But
yeah, Sauron's... Oh, yeah. He's a lizard, but whatever.
But it's enjoyable. I really... And they've decided to send an island back to the primordial... its primordial state. And that island is Staten Island.
Yup. He's like, okay, that was...
And Spider-Man notes that he would have preferred the Savage Land.
Well, yeah, but now the Savage Land is closer to home. It's like Euro Disney.
It's a fun issue. Unus the Untouchable also shows up.
And gets covered in webbing because he's pitiful.
Yes, and also hilarious because his name is one letter away from being Anus the Untouchable.
Yeah, it's really good. There's a lot of dialogue in here, but most of it is really funny.
Yes, Kalin is, he's definitely the chattiest person on the Flophouse, and that applies to his writing as well. There's a lot of dialogue.
He does really good Spider-Man, though, and Stegron and Sauron.
Yes.
Not so sure about the kids. Some of them seem a little off. Then again, I'm not sure when Glob Herman even got back. I think he was working for some bad guys or something, although I've missed a few issues, I think. But.
I thought they took all those guys back once they closed down the Hellfire Academy.
Oh, they did close it down? I don't know.
Like, you know, everybody there kind of buggered off once they were beaten.
Yeah. Okay. But I thought Glob Herman was hanging... Well, oh no! Actually, I think Glob Herman met Sauron at some point.
Oh, okay. Maybe he's the traitor.
Maybe. I would put money on him being the traitor, because he's kind of a jerk. He's a skeleton in a big, pink, slimy ball.
Anyway, that's what I read. David, what about you?
Do I have to pick? I guess we can avoid talking about robots for once.
Uh-huh. Well, we talked about Drift already.
Yeah, we already talked about Drift, so you failed already.
Pick things. I don't really want to talk about it again, but Bendis is actually writing Guardians of the Galaxy okay now, because he's using Venom.
I do love Venom.
Finally.
Which version of Venom is this?
Flash Thompson.
The one, Yeah, it was hanging on Flash Thompson. Flash Thompson sleeps through this issue. While, as we said last time, Venom took over Groot and went on a rampage. It's kind of like a talky, weird version of Alien. They have, well, the monster Groot rampaging around and they're trying to get him.
It's kind of Alien, kind of the thing.
Yeah. Drax manages to punch Venom off Groot, which I don't know how he does that. That's weird.
Well,
Venom doesn't want to be dogs. It wants to be us.
Yeah.
If he hits with enough force to make a really huge sound, that would knock Venom off.
This is possible. And he may have trouble bonding to a plant-based organism. We've never really seen that before.
Yeah, it did seem a little weird. But so you have the Venom symbiote wandering around the ship while they're looking for it. And then they walk past a sleeping Flash Thompson. Gamora wants to kill him. And space hit the Venom symbiote.
Then it's on Drax.
No. First it gets on Rocket Raccoon. And that is the best part. It was like Rocket... Venom... I did not know Venom symbiote could make guns. But apparently it can. And then,
I didn't think it could make things with moving parts. I thought it could only make knives and stabbing weapons.
Apparently, with Rocket, it can. he was holding a gun at the time, but somehow he makes two gun arms to shoot everyone and holes all over the ship. But yes, somehow Drax getting the symbiote doesn't seem as bad as Rocket having it. And yet Drax is this giant, huge monster symbiote. Oh, and Carol Danvers is apparently coming back, because she was in a few pages in the book, which is nice. It's like, finally Bendis is doing something with the Venom and the symbiote, even though Flash is asleep. And Carol Danvers is coming back, who was supposed to be in the book, too. It's like he forgets characters he drags into it.
Yes.
After treading water in the lead-up to the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, finally, now that it's out on DVD, the book is getting good.
Yes.
And Blu-ray.
Better late than never. Yeah, well, yeah.
And VOD.
Yeah.
We bought the Blu-ray. I watched it with my mum.
Available everywhere.
I liked it.
Oh, it's a good movie.
Of course.
It features Howard the Duck.
It does indeed.
Yeah. No, I don't think the word features is accurate there.
It includes Howard the Duck.
Yes, he is in at least two scenes.
He's a featured player. His name comes last.
Is played by not Seth Rogen, Seth Green.
Oh, that's who voiced him?
Yes.
Huh. I guess that's okay.
It's interesting. I recently reviewed Josie and the Pussycats for our website in amongst a bunch of other movies based on comics.
It
was a good art with a few problems.
And Josie and the Pussycats has Seth Green in it. In the boy band Du Jour.
Right.
With their hit song Backdoor Lover. It's fantastic.
That is a much better movie than a Josie and the Pussycats movie starring Tara Reid has any right to be.
She's perfect as Melody, though, you know? Like, Melody is meant to be blonde and completely stupid.
This is true.
So how could you cast better than Tara Reid? It's just perfect. And this was at the point where she was still hot, too, so...
This is true.
No, it was a good movie.
I mean, you know, not everybody can age as well as Rosario Dawson.
No. But, okay, so is that all we've read this fortnight? Not much reading
going
on.
Shall we move on to Christmas comics or holiday comics?
Let's talk about Christmas comics, shall we?
They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly.
So I actually collect them. So if I ever see any Christmas stuff on the cover of a comic, I will pick up that comic no matter how stupid it is. And I own quite a bunch of really dumb Christmassy comics. But for me, the best Christmas comics are the UK ones. Because most UK comics are weeklies. So they're able to do a Christmas issue every year. And it's not gonna, like, you imagine if the US comics did Christmas issues every year, it would be like half of the output. It'd be like 1/12 of your output would be Christmas comics, which just would not work.
Well, with Marvel double shipping, maybe 1/15, but yeah, it's like, or even like this week's Captain Marvel issue is like, it's a lead in to a Christmas comic. Apparently next issue is going to be the Christmas one. Late.
I mean, so Christmas specials in the US tend to be either one shots or a bit intermittent, whereas in the UK, what you would get would be an annual, which would be a hardback book, which would usually be released around Christmas time as a stocking stuffer, and those annuals would usually include at least one Christmassy story and usually several wintry stories, and then you'd quite often get a Christmas issue as well. So it's one of the fascinating anomalies that almost all the Christmas stories of Transformers come from the old UK comics.
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of Christmas issues which are all about, pretty much every single one of them is about some character learning to calm the hell down for a bit. Because of the joys of Christmas. So, like, one of them is Circuit Breaker, who's an insane, completely nutsoid chick with a bodysuit made of circuitry that allows her to electrocute robots.
Well, she kind of has a reason to be crazy.
Yeah, she
robots
does.
Tried to kill her and blew up an entire oil platform she was standing on.
Yes, that is true. And they crippled her for life, so... only her circuitry pattern hooker outfit can keep her walking.
Yes, admittedly, her outfit for revenge is not the best.
It may be literally the most sexually exploitative superhero outfit ever created outside of Top Cow.
It's definitely the most exploitative Marvel outfit.
It is ridiculous. It is...
hero outfit, anyway. Some villain ones, maybe.
But there's an issue where she learns to mellow out just a little bit around Christmas. There's an issue where Starscream, learns that if you pretend to learn the meaning of Christmas, it can really piss off some Autobots, which is fun. He deliberately saves a busload full of people just to annoy Streetwise, which is a fantastic little story. There's a, there's a Jetfire story about him learning to accept the fact that he wasn't born on Cybertron, which is an interesting little Christmas vignette. There's a snowball fight story called Cold Comfort and Joy. And there's a text story which gets into one of the things that will happen if you're looking at Christmas stories is that inevitably, if you have a set of Christmas stories, say you have five Christmas stories, you have five Christmas comics, inevitably at least one of those Christmas comics will feature either It's a Wonderful Life or A Christmas Carol as the basis for the story plot. So if you buy five random ones, you will get at either one of those stories at some point.
I'd rather have the Christmas Carol versions, because I don't like It's a Wonderful Life.
And
don't you know me, Bert?
There's a text story about Dreadwind, who was the letter opener. the letter page answerer at that point, learning that he needs to get the hell out of the offices and stop trying to hog the letters page because Blaster's going to take it over. because of a visitation from ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. So of course, there is that Christmas Carol pastiche, even in a Transformers comic. But, I mean, those...
Well, of course, because we have robot ghosts.
Yes.
It's common.
Well, the Ghost of Christmas Future is actually Action Master Blaster, who comes in and takes over the letters page. Which, it's ridiculous that that old UK comic has such a convoluted continuity about the letters page. but that sort of stuff is you get in any UK series. So each year there's a prog released around this time for 2000 AD, which is not Christmas themed, but it comes out around Christmas. And, usually there's a Christmassy type issue of either 2000 AD or, Judge Dredd magazine. Which is interesting because they don't really celebrate Christmas in that future. So it's sort of a wintry issue with allusions to Christmas, which is also always fascinating in sci-fi stuff, is how they'll do their holiday stuff, whether they'll just out and out have Christmas or whether they'll make up some crap that's sort of like
Life Day.
Yes. I kind of prefer made up holidays that are like Christmas.
Are you saying that, Wookiees don't celebrate the birth of our Messiah?
Oh, that's perfect. Fuzzy Messiah.
There's always a Christmas issue of the Beano as well, you know, like the snow-capped Christmas issue, which usually involves at least one story about Santa being real. That's the other one. You know, it's a Wonderful Life. Santa is actually real, so or A Christmas Carol. You're going to get one of those in any set of Christmas stories you pick up. It just happens. I've got an Elvira special sitting beside me, which is the Elvira Haunted Holidays special for House of Mystery, and it features a Christmas Carol pastiche starring Elvira. And drawn by Frank Springer of Dazzler fame, which means that yes, the breasts are lovingly drawn throughout, because that's Frank Springer for you. But I mean the other one that will come up sometimes is The Night Before Christmas. Like, people will do a modification of that poem, you know.
Yeah, because it's fun to parody.
Yes. Yeah. But, yeah, that's all I wanted to say about Christmas comics for now. What about you guys? Do you have any favorites?
Okay. Well, this summer when I was at the comics convention in Toronto, I found a bunch of those 90s Marvel Christmas specials for $1 each and snapped them up for future Christmas consumption. A lot of the stories, you know, they're a little disposable, but there are a couple of gems in there. I was quite fond of a Tom DeFalco, Sal Buscema story, in which we learn how Odin inspired the legend of Santa Claus, and also it involves Thor hitting a vaguely Grinch-like troll with his hammer. So that's pretty great. But the one that I really want to bring up is not a Christmas story at all. It is a Hanukkah story.
Oh, nice!
And because Marvel only has so many Jewish heroes, you kind of got to scrape the bottom of the barrel for this one. And so that means It is Doc Samson who is attempting to teach a group of exceptionally stupid children the story of Hanukkah.
When's this from?
It's from the 90s. I think 93. Peter David wrote it.
Oh.
And it starts off, you know... Doc Samson is in his 80s costume, which is kind of like this red leather thing with plunging man cleavage and no sleeves and a green mullet.
It's a John Byrne design, I believe.
Yes.
which means that it is ridiculously 80s.
Yes. And so, of course, he is wearing this while he teaches at this Hebrew school, but because he's doing that, he's got a little yarmulke perched atop his green mullet.
I had no idea he was even Jewish, although Samson should have known.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, that's awesome.
It's great. The kids initially think that Maccabees are those little, are like little cookies. Thinking of macaroons. And so Samson starts explaining to it in terms that they understand, replacing, you know, the evil king in the story with Ultron. And at some point, the kids credit the Human Torch for making the flame go when there was no oil left.
Of course.
Oh, that's horribly blasphemous.
And eventually, Samson's just yelling at these kids. Look, kid, the Jews beat the Syrians. They cleaned out the temple. They found the lamp. Only enough oil to burn for one day. It burned for 8. Get it? Got it. Good.
It is admittedly not a tremendous miracle. It's not up there with the mosaic miracles of like parting the Red Sea or some shit like that, is it? I mean, it's like,
yeah, okay, he'll make the thing burn for a little bit longer than it should.
It's a winter festival holiday. It's like most cultures have one.
Yeah.
Gotta start somewhere. Not everything could be Mithras or Saturnalia.
A lot of things can.
Yeah. Well, yes, Christmas is now. It stole from both of them.
But anyway, this story is delightful, and I'm sure you can find the Marvel Holiday Special from 1993 for no more than a dollar. I'd recommend you pick it up.
That's good.
What about you, David?
Well, there is this tale about a geologist named Dreyer who went down to the South Pole to explore and at the Mountains of Madness, and there's an illustrated version by I.N.J. Colbard, which is beautiful. Actually, no, I don't think I have any Christmas comics.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think H.P. Lovecraft isn't super festive.
Well, the monsters they find there kind of are. I mean, they're sort of these big trunk pointed things that have a star on top.
Oh, my goodness.
At the Mountains of Madness is a twisted Christmas story. And the Shoggoths are Christmas pudding that has gained sentience.
Oh, so like the
but
magic...
Aside from that, no.
The magic pudding.
The magic pudding, yeah, sure. Yeah, no, I don't... Well, the only one I can remember is... I think there was an Avengers Assemble comic from a year or two ago. It was pretty good, but... Aside from that, no, I don't have Christmas comics.
Oh, that's so disappointing. So what about... Isn't there a Christmas issue of Spectacular Spider-Man? Is it Spectacular Spider-Man?
Which one are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of the one with a Santa with a gun on the cover. It's a
yes,
Spider-Man.
That is Spectacular Spider-Man. That's also Peter David, actually.
Yeah. What else is there? Oh, there's the classic one I've talked about before, which is the Marvel 2-in-1 thing/Ghost Rider story where the Miracle Man tries to be reborn as the baby Jesus, which is a fantastic story, and I need to do a proper write-up on it one of these days.
And there's the Marvel team-up issue where the Human Torch and Spider-Man let Sandman go because it's Christmas, and he's just going to visit his mom.
Yeah, that's true. I remember that one, yeah. There's that one. There's actually a Captain Atom story set during Christmas too. It's not particularly Christmassy, but it happens at Christmas time. So, that's one of the interesting variants of the Christmas story is the story that incidentally happens at Christmas time. You know the.
Well, at least in movies, those tend to be the better ones.
Like Die Hard.
Or Iron Man 3.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so Die Hard is a little more Christmassy. And you've got the, if you consider that Alan Rickman in that is basically the Grinch.
I well, yeah.
Yes, so in my Punisher holiday special, you have a story of the Punisher getting lured to a mall, and after malls closed, and all these guys dressed as security guards trying to hunt him down and kill him in the mall. And it's set during Christmas. The crime boss who tried to have him killed wanted it as a Christmas present for himself. But Frank Castle kind of ruins it, and that's where he impales somebody with some reindeer. And because he's out of ammo, he has no weapons because he has to stash his guns while the mall is still open. And so it features him pelting people with Christmas ornaments and then killing a dude with a reindeer display. And after that, he gets himself some guns, and at one point he swings into action using the tinsel on a Christmas tree. Like he literally, it's just ridiculous. But it's largely incidental that it's Christmas in this story. And that sort of story can work really well, and it's basically the kind of story you want if you're doing the Punisher. Because the other story in the special is about the Punisher teaching a child to learn to appreciate his family around Christmas time. Because the kid is in witness protection and he's really pissed off at his dad because he's had to leave his family. And so the Punisher comes along and he kills all these guys who were trying to kill the family and the kid. And the kid's dog gets shot in the leg. And the Punisher, while the Punisher is bandaging up the kid's dog, he lectures the kid about how he should appreciate his family and how he shouldn't be such a douchebag around Christmas time. And the kid goes back in and he says, "I love you, Daddy." I'm just like, the Punisher is teaching a kid the meaning of Christmas?
That's kind of weird.
The kid who seconds ago just saw him gun down a dude who was holding the kid at gunpoint himself is teaching the children about Christmas. That maybe don't work. It's a little bit of a stretch. So yeah, I love Christmas comics because you're required to juxtapose elements. So the moment you decide to put Starscream in a Christmas story, you're juxtaposing elements. The moment you decide to put the Punisher in a Christmas story, there's one with the Hulk, which is fantastic, which is, it's a Grey Hulk story, and the Rhino is trying to go legitimate, so he dresses up as Santa Claus and uses the Santa hat to cover his Rhino horn. And
wait, he's still wearing the costume.
Yeah, he's still in his Rhino costume because he can't take it off at that point. And so he is being the in-store Santa, and he's just getting more and more pissed off at the kids. And like when he sits down to be the in-store Santa, he breaks the chair and they have to build him a reinforced Santa chair. He gets so pissed off because the kids are all asking him for action figures of all these superheroes. And he's like, "Don't you want one of the villains? What about the Rhino?" And the kids are just like, "They're losers! Who wants a figure of the villains?" And he just loses his shit. And he goes crazy in the mall and the Hulk has to beat him up. But that juxtaposition of imagery, like the moment you put the Rhino in a Santa costume, it is freaking gold. And that's Peter David again, by the way.
Yeah. For a Jewish guy, he sure loves Christmas.
He's done quite a few holiday stories. Yeah, it's fantastic stuff. I mean, I don't know if Lee and Kirby ever did a Christmas story. That's a,
I don't think so. Actually, I was just reading a thing this week about how there really are no, like, Silver Age Marvel Christmas stories. I think the first one is that Marvel team-up one.
Well, back then everyone was Jewish, wasn't they?
Well.
Kind of.
Well, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, Archie was Jewish as hell, and they celebrated Christmas back in the Silver Age.
Yeah.
So.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello. Successful guest. Special guest. Matthew!
Okay.
Matt, we were just talking about Christmas comics. Do you have any Christmas comics you like?
Oh, I'm trying to remember what ones I've read. It'd probably be back in the 90s when Marvel was doing their holiday specials and things like that.
Oh, yes. Yes. Rob brought them up a bit.
I did discuss the Hanukkah story with Doc Samson.
That one I don't think I ever read. And of course, I've seen the Starscream Christmas one, which I heard part of the conversation, so I'm guessing that came up already.
Yep. Yeah, which is fantastic. I love that story. But, I mean, like, it's not a comic, but the He-Man Christmas special, which is mostly awful. But has this one fantastic element, which is that Skeletor learns the meaning of Christmas, which is so delightful, seeing Skeletor being like, I don't want to be good. just so nice. And that's why I love those Christmas specials. It's just that immediate juxtaposition of elements.
Tell me about this Christmas.
Yeah.
I mean, the Punisher got a couple of holiday specials, probably because it is so tempting to say the Punisher plus Christmas. That's hilarious. I mean, it's the same logic behind having the Punisher team up with Archie. Like, it's just so obvious.
Oh, okay. I just thought of a holiday special that I have in memory, which is the Ambush Bug Nothing Special. It's got a picture of him in a giant stocking. He's in a Santa outfit. And like much of the like early 90s / later Ambush Bug stuff in general, I mainly remember it being depressing. Like, I want to... there were a few different Ambush Bug specials. One of them was about him trying to get involved in the 1991 or 1992 summer crossover at DC, which was Eclipso, The Darkness Within. And so he kept going from like comic to comic in the pages of this special, trying to get involved in the crossover, and like Valor punched him out because, you know, that's what you do when you meet a new superhero. But because Valor is basically a Superman analog, it sent him hurtling into space.
Just, oh, poor Ambush Bug.
So Ambush Bug is like DC's version of Dupe? He just hops between comics?
Well, he knows he's a comic book character. So he's kind of like She-Hulk in that regard. Okay, I guess I've mixed up my Ambush Bug specials, because the Ambush Bug Nothing Special doesn't have the Christmas cover on it. So, oh, no, it's the Ambush Bug Stocking Stuffer. Okay, I got my specials mixed up. Yeah, the Nothing Special is the really depressing one. Whereas I don't remember if the Holiday Special is the one where he gets his arch-villain, who is an Argyle sock in a Doctor Doom mask, whose name is Arg! Guile. Argyle.
Oh, I think I've heard of that thing before. DC.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fascinating curve for Ambush Bug, since he started out as a Superman villain, like an annoying trickster type, like a lesser Mr. Mixelplick. Ugh. Mixelspitlick? I never know how to say that.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to be able to pronounce it. It's just it's meant to be read nonsense. It's not meant to be sounded out. That's the point.
Oh, that's what it was. The Ambush Bug Stocking Stuffer is where they parodied Steve Ditko's Mr. A, because you want that in a Christmas special.
Nothing says festive like the polarization of right and wrong.
Yeah, like a little bit of objectivism. That's what Santa Claus needs.
A is A, ho is ho.
Well, an objectivist Santa wouldn't give anybody anything. He'd just keep it all for himself.
Right. It's just a bunch of moochers.
Yeah. Santa is like the opposite of Ayn Rand's philosophy.
Yeah.
So is Jeebus, for that matter.
Well, she did come from communist Russia, or I guess not quite communist yet Russia.
She did hate religion.
It was Russia before it was really bad.
Yeah, but to be fair, she freaking hated the commies as well. Like, her entire...
And yet, the little group of her friends, she turned into a communist conclave, basically, that she ran.
She hated a lot.
Why are we
things.
Talking about Ayn Rand? Oh, comic books. Damn it, Ditko.
Actually, I didn't even realize until fairly recently the Ayn Rand influence on Spider-Man's Rogues Gallery.
Really?
Well, apparently, she referred to, the moochers and the parasites, but also the looters.
Oh, of course.
He's not exactly a sterling gem of the Spider-Man Ditko Rogues Gallery.
This is true. I've always been somewhat fond of him due to his the fact that he has a portable hot air balloon in his costume.
Oh, gosh. But, the Christmas is a good time. I like it. It's not crappy like Halloween. It's awesome.
Oh.
It's much more red and green instead of orange.
Orange is festive.
No. Orange is lame.
You read Afterlife with Archie, whose main color is orange.
I don't read Afterlife with Archie because they don't put them out.
Well, yeah, it would have been nice if they had one out for Halloween. They have a Christmas special, and it took me a while to remember one of the characters is not Commissioner Gordon. Eddie's father really looks like Commissioner Gordon. It's weird.
It's Veronica's father. Hiram Lodge.
One of them. Hiram.
So, Matt, since you're our special Christmas guest, what did you read this week?
Well, in more of a British than American Christmas tradition, I've been picking up old annuals from the United Kingdom.
Nice!
Yeah,
I don't know why I bleated then, but yeah, nice.
And I've got here two, which are RoboMachine featuring the GoBots, or one of them is RoboMachine featuring the challenge of the GoBots. I don't know why they have two different logos.
Yes, I've got those. Those are awesome. They feature a text story where the
GoDaikins?
Yeah, the GoDaikins appear for like 2 seconds just to be mentioned and then disappear again.
Yeah, and they're very specific. They name three of them. One is Bio Dragon, who is from Bioman, the Super Sentai.
Yeah. So the RoboMachine label was used to release toys from, what was the toy line called?
The GoBot? Machine Robo?
No.
Chogokin?
Yeah, the...
Oh, Chogokin, the really big, intricate toy thingies, like...
Was it die-cast and all like that?
Yeah. Those toys were released under Machine Man and Robo Machine. Robo Machine in Europe and Machine Man in Australia. So those toys get mentioned in the annual just for a second. I love that. And they really play up Vamp and that as monsters in those stories too.
Yeah, here it is. Let's see. The Govotronic space shuttle, Spacey, could only just keep up to the Guardian power suit. Then, as Scooter slowed down to let Spacey pull ahead again, three brightly colored spaceships appeared in the sky in front of them. They were Daidenjin, Vavilos, and Biodragon, Gobots from the peaceful planet of Godaikin. They exchanged greetings with Spacey and Scooter and then began to talk in a language that Matt could not understand. Then, as suddenly as they had appeared, they disappeared once again. And...
Wait, isn't Biodragon one of the Metal Heroes things?
No, Vavilos is. Well, Biodragon might be too. I know Bioman is the Bioman robot, I think.
Yeah. That's weird seeing like Super Sentai stuff show up with Gobots.
Yeah.
And be explicitly Gobots from another planet.
Yeah. Is that...
And be there for like a second. Like
you just what's blink and you miss.
Yeah. I love those annuals.
And their planet Godaikin also shows up in the Search for Spacey, which is a little game that's in the centerfold. But the other annual that I got besides Gobots was the Gem 1988 annual.
Oh, outrageous. Nice.
Which is interesting because it actually has comics in it, whereas the Robo Machine ones don't. Although the art isn't very good, and also they color Synergy Caucasian instead of purple, but they don't give her irises. So she is this purple-haired woman in a bandana with no eyes on a computer screen. And I mean, the art's not... Well, it's not great art. But I think the best part is a message from Mr. Raymond, where the evil record producer, Eric Raymond, tells the readers about the Misfits. And it's this very propaganda-ish kind of thing. Let's see. Hello there, readers. My name's Eric Raymond, and I'd like to say sincerely how pleased I am to have this opportunity to communicate with you, and maybe to straighten one or two things out. Some of you may have been led into thinking that I have something against Jerrica Benton and Gem and the Holograms, that I'm trying to ruin their career in favor of my own group, the Misfits, and thereby take over Starlight Music. Let me say once and for all, nothing could be further from the truth, and as anyone in the music business will tell you, lying is not my style. Far from it, believe me. In fact, the only time I ever bend the truth a little is when I try to speak well of Jerrica Benton, because that girl is so confused and upset that she doesn't know how badly her wild allegations and unruly behavior are affecting her late father's company. Taking up with that talentless gaggle of groaners, Gem and the Holograms, has completely flipped the poor child's mind, changing her from an innocent youngster into the scheming, power-crazed maniac we see today. If only she could learn by the example of my own sweet girls. You can meet them on the next page. The Misfits, Pizzazz, Clash, Roxy, and Stormer. Have you ever seen a gentler, more peace-loving set of young ladies? And they're not just beautiful, believe me. The Misfits have real musical talent. They're a group for today who understand young people and give them the music that they want instead of trying to cover up their lack of talent with fancy stage shows like Gem and the Holograms. These shy, sweet-natured musicians live only for their music and the pleasure it brings to their millions of adoring, law-abiding fans.
Oh, I love the emphasis on law-abiding. Like, oh, that's fantastic.
Anyway, oh, I must go now. So this is your good friend, Eric Raymond, signing off with some advice that stuck-up Jerrica Benton would do well to remember. You can fool some of the people all of the time, all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. Have a nice day, Eric Raymond. And really, the badness in the art, I don't know, it juxtaposes with his message even more than if they were drawn well, I think, because even Stormer has this snarl going on, and she's the nice one.
Oh, which reminds me, the Gem comic has confirmed that the Misfits will be there.
Yes.
Which we didn't know last time, did we?
No, we didn't. We hope. New designs. We now know that they no longer have a saxophonist, which is kind of a disappointment.
Well, there's still four of them.
I just like the idea that they were a band. They didn't have a drummer, but they had a saxophonist.
Drummers are better anyway, but the drum was always in the music. But also, didn't they say that like they wouldn't be as explicitly criminal?
Yes, so they're probably not pushing people into volcanoes this time.
Yeah, they wouldn't officially be attempting murder every other
episode. Or, you know, trying to run down an orphanage with a bulldozer.
I hope they still keep that part. Yeah.
Well, the weird thing about this annual with regards to the Misfits is that Jeddah, the English Misfit, isn't here at all, even though the other later year characters show up, like Hispanic drummer Rhea, who took over from Shauna, and then they've got Dance, their choreographer, and Video, their music video camera woman.
The guy who named the guy in charge of naming characters was on vacation that week.
Apparently he gave up in later seasons. Go from Stormer to Dance.
Well, it is Dance with an S. I don't know if that means she's German or something.
There's no excuse for Video, though.
No.
Why does a videographer even have like a stage name?
Well, I think her real name was Vivian, so from Vivian to Video.
Oh. Yeah. Maybe it's Vivian, maybe. And she's actually a cousin of Ronnie James Dio.
Maybe if she's a murderess and she could kill the radio star,
that would require an alias.
That would justify an alias. I'm sorry. That was inappropriate, and I'm sure it will get cut.
Well, and the other weird thing going on is that Tech Rat, their boy George, secret tech guy, doesn't seem to be in here, but Zipper, who is this thug from the first miniseries and first season, shows up, except instead of looking like the kind of 1950s Marlon Brando kind of street tough that he used to look like, he looks exactly like Flash Thompson.
Oh.
Like red hair, and well, somewhere between Flash Thompson and Chucky the Murder Doll.
Ooh, that's frightening.
Yeah, I haven't had time to look through all of it, but apparently the Misfits. There are tech stories too, tech stories in a couple of comics. In one of the tech stories, the Misfits talk about being on set for a dog food commercial for doing the soundtrack for it, and apparently they made the director eat a tin of dog food. I don't know why. So, yeah, Andrew, can you speak more of the annual's tradition, I guess?
Oh, I already talked about that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Yes, okay. I did. But,
the British tradition.
Yeah, it is. It is a British tradition. It's awesome. I love annuals. The fact that they're hardcover is pretty important. So it makes them less disposable than normal comics. So you think about the way comics have always been, was a disposable unit. Kids would read them, they'd swap them out, they'd throw them to other people, they'd chuck them out when they get a bit ratty. But with an annual, the entire point was to write your name in the front and say it's yours and to keep it. And so, generally speaking, they were much higher quality productions than your normal comic. They had better art, they had better stories, they were much higher quality. Come the 80s, they were producing so many of them for anything. Like, I've got a Knight Rider annual, and there's an A-Team annual. There's annuals for anything, and those were produced on the cheap, and they are crapola. They're terrible. But, I mean, the contrast between something like the Jam annual, which would be produced on spec by a company who had, like, 10 minutes to put it out, and the Transformers annuals, which were the high class, you can keep it parts of the Transformers output, is radical. So, I mean, the Transformers annuals are really, really nice. And say, like, my Knight Rider annual is kind of awful. Yeah, so they're nothing like a US annual, which traditionally were reprint volumes, and then Jack and Stan decided to use them as an extra issue each year.
The kind of interesting thing about these is that both the Gem annual and the Robo Machine GoBots annuals were made by World International Publishing, an Edgemont company, and Edgemont were the same group who did the My Little Pony comics.
Yeah, Edgemont's output is not that stellar.
Not that great, yeah. Although I was surprised by how much better the GoBots annual ended up than I was expecting. I mean, I was expecting some real garbage, and it's like, yeah, you know, this is readable, and it's not necessarily insulting my intelligence.
And Tux is downright terrifying. Because they render him as basically a jack-o'-lantern wearing a top hat. Which is terrifying in a giant robot.
I think my favorite bit is actually what they do to Baron Von Joy, who is now Professor Von Joy, who... Maybe I'll just read it. The professor was one of Gobotron's most brilliant scientists, and he was shaped like a giant gray Porsche. Once he had been one of the most evil and boastful Gobots on the planet, but he had been captured by the Guardians, and they had managed to reprogram his circuits. Now he was no longer evil. However, he was as boastful as ever.
One of the other peculiarities of that, of the Robo Machines thing, is that I think everybody but Crasher, who is female in the cartoon, is male in those annuals.
Yeah, I think you're right, because Facey does show up and she's a dude.
And I think Vamp is also referred to with male pronouns, so...
Oh, that's a shame. That was like one of the few good things the GoBots cartoon did good. It was like, just make random characters female.
Yeah. No, it's an odd little peculiarity there. I believe Crasher is still female though.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, but nobody else, oddly enough. Okay, so shall we go on to the appendectomy?
Yes, and I think it's time for a special festive appendectomy.
So I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Though it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you. Love and joy come to you, and to you your carol too, and God bless you and send you a happy new year, and God send you a happy new year.
Thank you, whoever has the jingle bells.
I assume that's David.
Yeah.
This is a character created by the late, great Mark Gruenwald and the still alive, but still probably also great, Alan Kupperberg. I speak of the Son of Santa. He's Nick Norris. He's from Earth 8336, and his occupation is gift bringer.
Nick Norris? Wait, so Santa's actual last name is Norris? What?
No, that's his adopted name.
Yes.
Okay, so Santa had a son and then he got adopted away?
Yes,
what?
Santa had a son, or what Santa and Maria Claus had a son. 6 months later, Maria died, and Santa decided he was unfit to raise the baby by himself, so he sent one of his elves, Agonists, to find the boy a good home.
Why can't the elves raise him? There's a shitload of them.
I think that's Agonistes. It looks Greek to me.
If they just raised him himself, that would kind of just be the movie Elf. Which is admittedly a really good movie. But this elf does not look much like Bob Newhart.
No, he kind of looks like Peter Parker with more muscles.
Oh, Nick Norris.
Yes, Nick Norris. Oh, you mean the elf?
Yeah, the elf does not look much like Bob Newhart. Nor does the son of Santa look much like Will Ferrell.
No.
Anyway, so the elf found what he thought was a good home, the Norrises, and left them the boy under the tree. But unfortunately, his adopted father regularly beat him, and his mother was always off fooling around somewhere.
Oh,
and so he ran away at the age of 14 and a half. At the age of 18 and a half, he was standing on a corner without a dime to his name, trying to figure out how to get a meal. And the elf came to him, said he was a talent scout, and offered him a flight to Tokyo.
That, by the way, is the point in the story where they make a Midnight Cowboys reference.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's probably male prostitution.
That's the point where the guy is like, this little dude approached me and I was like, if he's gonna go all, he thinks I'm hanging out here cause I wanna go all Midnight Cowboys, he's got another thing coming. So, like, there's a lot of-
talking to me.
There's a lot of unnecessary not gays in the start of the story.
I don't know if the story goes
out of its way to say, no, this isn't male prostitution.
My guess would be that somebody,
Grunwald wrote this, and Grunwald was from Wisconsin, where there are no prostitutes, or apparently black people. Because there's a bit of naivete in his writing. Like when he had the guy who later became Battlestar, he became U.S. Agent's Bucky. And it took pointing that out to him why naming a black guy Bucky was a bad idea. It wasn't. And so my suspicion is that he just wrote this, and then somebody said, maybe you should put something in there to indicate that he is not, in fact, a male prostitute.
I don't know, because it's a weird little story. It's a fun little story.
So anyway, he gets on this plane, but then the elf pulls a gun, hijacks the plane, and then forces Nick to jump out of the plane with him over the North Pole. Okay. Upon landing, he leads him to the frozen corpse of Santa Claus.
It should be pointed out that Santa's workshop is this huge high-tech facility, like something drawn by John Byrne, the master of the world would own. Like ridiculously over the top comic book high tech with all these giant machines and it's all wrecked inside. So, the frozen corpse of Santa Claus.
Yes, and apparently Santa Claus's base had been wrecked and Santa had been killed by the Anti-Claus, a despoiler of given gifts. Who is thin, wears a black suit, has no heart, and rides a what appears to be a bulldozer sleigh. No, sorry, just a jagged sleigh with a big skull on it that is pulled by two flying wild boars.
And he's got man cleavage going all the way down to his belly button.
It's very Iron Fist. Yeah. So the elf told Nick about his origins and about the Anti-Claus. And then he was compelled to wear a Santa suit, and then felt a rush of energy as he was now the son of Santa. All right, so the Anti-Claus then announced his plans to slay Santa's successor.
Did he
battled.
Try to slay him with a sleigh?
It does not appear so.
Unfortunate.
Although at some point Nick does stab the Anti-Claus in the chest with a screwdriver, but of course he had no heart. And then he finally traps him within Santa's magic bag, which has virtually unlimited space inside. So he travels.
Andrew, close the window. What are you doing?
What?
A lot of wind.
Oh, that's just my fan. Sorry.
So, along with this elf.
I'll turn around the other way.
Along with this elf and a couple of reindeer, the son of Santa agreed to take over Santa's job, although he'd do things his own way, starting with making his new workshop in the Bahamas.
Okay.
Now, while the son of Santa does not try to kill, while the Anti-Claus does not try to kill son of Santa with his sleigh, son of Santa does attempt to smash Santa's sleigh onto the Anti-Claus and kill him with it, which is awesome. And the other thing is that the two surviving reindeer survived by being shielded by the corpses of all the other reindeers.
Oh.
So,
wow.
Yeah. They were shielded from the Holocaust by the bodies of their fellows, is the way it's described in the comic.
That is
really
upset.
Yeah.
That's all messed up.
Well, the cover does say, "Not for kiddies," and then in brackets, "We mean it." So... This is Bizarre Adventures number 34.
The
art is really nice.
The headshot of the son of Santa looks really Elvis to me. You know, like kind of...
Kinda.
Well, the raised eyebrow, the going... I can just see him going, uh-huh.
Yeah.
You're the son of Santa, uh-huh.
No, it's... There's definite... allusions to Midnight Cowboys here. This is that one headshot is a little bit deceptive.
Now we know this guy isn't from Earth 616 because we have seen that Santa alive and well.
Uh-huh.
But I almost wonder if the Anti-Claus is how can you just battle Santa over the years. There's only one Santa. I'm wondering if maybe he goes forth and attacks other dimension Santa Clauses.
So
this would necessitate bringing them all together in an event that I can only call Santaverse.
Every Santa ever.
That's right. I believe they have that every year in New York City.
Well, I guess the other way you could go with the Anti-Claus is that maybe he, to get all real Grunwaldian for a moment, maybe he's like a cosmic force that opposes all holiday icons, shape-shifting to become like an anti-Easter bunny, too.
Well, Bizarre Adventures features another Santa Claus who falls off the roof and on top of somebody's father and kills him, which prompts the child to go on a murderous rampage. And then when he finally confronts Santa, Santa says, "No kid's ever seen Santa Claus and lived to tell about it." And he has a machine gun.
So it's a cross between the Santa Claus and Silent Night, Deadly Night?
Bizarrely enough, that is... Bizarrely adventurously enough, that's exactly what I was going to say.
but the point being, there's actually another Santa in this as well, who's a cynical Santa who doesn't like how annoying New York is at Christmas time.
Oh, wait but a minute. Yeah, this can't be Earth 616 because Santa Claus teamed up with She-Hulk in the later 1980s.
Yeah. So there's at least three different Santa Clauses just in this one issue. So you've got that many to draw on if you want to do a Santa Claus crossover thing.
You can draw from the various Marth alternate Earths. You've probably got an Age of Apocalypse Santa Claus.
Well, yeah. Well, plus there's any time any Marvel character has dressed up as Santa, I'm sure the Thing has.
Well, yes.
You just spin that off in its own universe.
But the other thing to think about is that this is part of their creator-owned push. So the copyrights for these characters are very specifically owned by the creators. Like the story
Bizarre Adventure stories?
Yes, underneath the title for Son of Santa, it says story and characters copyright Mark Gruenwald.
Yeah.
Huh.
So it is creator owned, and so
a creator owned Santa Claus original character. Do not steal.
So
well, the anti-clause is original.
So the anti-clause and Son of Santa can't just be casually used in 616 without paying royalties to Mark Gruenwald.
He's a pun on Son of Satan. I think they can do that. Maybe make him look
well. They actually have their own Son of Santa, Son of Santa from What The.
From What The, yes.
Yeah.
Wait. Yeah, there
there's another Son of Santa?
Yes, there are two Sons of Santa.
There is.
He looks like Son of Satan with a wreath on his chest.
Yes.
Yes, that is
that is ridiculously dumb.
Oh, created by Kirk Busiek.
Oh, and James Fry. I like him.
So they can't just use him. They can't use this Son of Santa character. On the other hand, he could get optioned for a movie. So that would make a fantastic Christmas movie, don't you think?
Oh, just like Santa Claus the movie.
It can't be as bad as some of the Santa movies that already exist.
I'm pretty sure this one won't end up with John Lithgow's frozen corpse floating off into space.
He could play Santa.
It's got to have at least one frozen corpse in there, you know.
Yeah, you might as well have John Lithgow be the frozen Santa.
And in a movie, you don't just have to talk about it. You can actually show how the couple of reindeers survived by being shielded by the corpses of their fellows. So I mean, that's
bloody CG covered.
Yeah. You actually show the Anti-Claus slaughtering everybody. It'd be awesome. I mean,
well, with Marvel creator-owned stuff, I know they've been trying to get a movie of Mort the Dead Teenager off the ground for years, and I don't know if that's Larry Hama's copyright or if Marvel owns that.
It's not owned by Larry Hama's copyright. We were talking about doing a character profile in the handbooks a while back, and I don't think it went through. I think we did profile him in the handbooks, come to think of it.
Oh.
Well,
and I think we always have to check with the Indizia to see if it's owned by its creator or not. That's how we got to do Christar.
Dr. Death is also a character in Bizarre Adventures who appeared in two issues and is owned by Larry Hama and has been optioned for a movie, although that movie never seemed to have had anything happen to it. So, you know, Son of Santa movie. That's what I want to see. That's where that character needs to go. We need to get a nice, strong royalty check for Mark Gruenwald and Ellen Kupperberg.
In this case, it would be the estate of Mark Gruenwald.
Well, yes. It'd be good. It'd be nice.
Come on. There just aren't enough, you know, are there any, like, specifically Christmassy movies in theaters this year?
There's the Christian-y Christmas movies.
Yeah, that Kirk Cameron one.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, yeah! Kirk
Is any Christmassy at all? I have not actually seen the original.
Little tiny
Does it take place at Christmas?
I think so.
Okay, well, that kind of counts then, I guess. But this would clearly be more in the, like, Scrooged vein.
Yeah, we haven't had a good Scrooge holiday comedy in a while. It's actually been funny.
Annie does take place at Christmas.
Okay.
Just for the record.
Yeah, I was going to say, Andrew, did you watch that during your big movie binge?
Annie?
Yeah.
No, I didn't rewatch any of the versions of Annie. I would recommend the Disney television version. It's less based on the comic and more just, what do you call it, the stage version. There are a lot of problems introduced in the 1980s movie by making it bigger scope and making it more based on the comics. Like the scene where they do A Hard Knock Life and they're singing about, you know, it's a hard knock life for us. And they have these huge dance numbers where they're doing acrobatics and jumping around each other, and there's hundreds of kids, and it's just like, well, okay, so they're starving orphans, but they can do acrobatics. So, I mean, they can't be that bad off. I mean, so it really hurts the tone of the piece, like in a way that the Disney telemovie version is, because it's smaller scale, it actually helps the production quite a lot, and it works a lot better. Uh-huh. You don't get that awesome shock of red hair on Annie though, unfortunately, because they didn't do that in the stage play.
They couldn't afford hair dye.
Couldn't afford a wig.
No, they would, an actual redhead.
The stage play is just really downplaying a lot of the elements from the comics.
Does Daddy Warbucks have hair, or what the hell?
Does he still hate the New Deal?
No, he doesn't. He's actually friends with what's his name? Is it J.A.
Frank Delano Roosevelt?
Franklin. Yeah, the guy in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
They're actually friends.
So the existence of Franklin Roosevelt does not actually cause him to enter a death-like state.
No, they have a song together, I think.
Does he do like a dance number in the wheelchair?
I can't remember. But
Is Eleanor there? Does he rap?
but it's, yeah, the politics of it is completely reversed from the comic strip. The 1980s movie brings back in his Indian valet, who's a racially troubling character, and various other elements from the comics. So it's much more based on the comic than the actual stage play is, but pulling away from the actual source material actually helps Annie quite a lot as a musical. So I haven't seen the latest version, but I'll probably see it eventually. Yeah.
So why wasn't your Annie on your list of comic book based movies?
Because it's only okay. It's not great.
And yet Mystery Men got on there.
Shut up! I love Mystery Men.
I still think the most glaring omission is those Hellboy movies.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. I was thinking about Flash Gordon, Hellboy should be like in the top five.
I think the most glaring omission from Mystery Men is the Flaming Carrot himself. But
if Flaming Carrot is in there, the movie might make some damn sense.
Wait, the Flaming Carrot would make the movie make more sense?
They didn't have a main character instead of being a crazy ball of stupid skits.
Well, no, the main character is clearly, Ben Stiller.
Yes, a furious man.
Mr. Furious.
He's the one with the character arc, with the main character arc.
Mystery Men is a movie that I want to like more than I actually like.
No, there are a couple of good ideas.
And there are lots
there.
Of good actors. I kind of like Hank Azaria's terrible accent.
No.
And you have to love William H. Macy.
I love William H. Macy.
It's hard to hate William H. Macy.
I shovel good, don't I?
It always seems like he's about to cry if you're mean to him.
Well, that is kind of his persona as an actor. I mean, have you seen Fargo?
Yeah, that's...
You shovel, I've seen you that shovel great, honey, but that doesn't make you a superhero. Oh, well, Mystery Men is good. I hate you. I hate you for
it's less than the sum of its
not,
parts.
It's just not that funny.
No.
And also that it contains one inexplicably gruesome death scene.
For no
I
reason.
Love that scene.
In the middle of the movie.
It's
if it had led up to the death scene, maybe?
It's crucial to the film that A, the scene is out of nowhere, and B, the death scene happens.
But it's in the middle of the goddamn movie, and the movie just keeps trucking along. It's a bad...
You just don't get it, son. That's the lamest thing somebody can say when somebody else disagrees with them on a movie. You just don't get it.
Well, that's just like your opinion, man.
Well, I mean, that's fine. I don't like the Hellboy movies as much as some other people, and I don't like Flash Gordon a particularly huge amount, so...
I don't know, mostly I've never gotten the appeal of Queen, but I don't know.
Oh.
What?
Well, that I disagree with you on strenuously, but I also detect that we have finished the podcast.
Well, in true holiday fashion, we've kind of abandoned the whole holiday thing, and now we're just bickering with each other. This couldn't be more like a Christmas episode if we each had a turkey drumstick clutched in our mitts.
At least it didn't become a musical episode.
It's still better than some Christmases. Nobody said anything racist.
Not intentionally.
Oh, this will be a Merry Christmas indeed.
Oh, well, I'll get to see my grandma anyway.
That's nice.
And maybe you'll get some turkey, the king of poultries.
We're having turkey tonight.
I love leftover turkey.
I almost wish I could eat turkey every day, but I guess after 365 days I would get tired of it.
Perhaps. But it'd be the sleepiest year of your life. Anyway, I guess after that ramble has been cut out, the episode will be at a decent length.
Short clip.
I'll sign off now. This is Andrew Sorahan.
Dying out of the podcast yet?
No, not yet. We've been bickering like a family at Christmas.
Right, do a formal sign off. You start, Rob, since you always start.
All right. Well, this is Rob London wishing you a Merry Christmas and to all a good night.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Nick Frost nipping at my nose. Wait, I'm David Anion. Doctor Who Christmas is coming.
Mid-frost? Bifrost? We're not going over the Rainbow Bridge or anything. For a quarter of the podcast, I'm Matt Karpowicz.
I freaking love Christmas! Yeah, son! See you later, guys. Andrew Sorahan.
Yay, we started early. We're done early.
I apologize for that last little outburst.
No, it's like Christmas wishes from Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
How the hell do I build a wall in the ocean around?
What are you doing? Are you playing Civilization or something?
No, I'm trying to draw a coastline map of the fantasy world. I'm playing a D&D because my DM, Jen's roommate, is shitty at drawing.
I see.
And it looks like crap, and it's like, no, I need a better map. I have to do it myself.
So you're cartographing.
Yeah, it's fun drawing all the little inlets and jetties and little tiny islands.
The fjords?
Whereas his is
Have you
big
put in
ball.
Any fjords?
What exactly is a fjord? I love the word, I forget what it is.
It's where Slarty Bartfast signs his name.
I know! that's pretty much my only reference for fjord. Is like,
well, there's also the parrot that's pining for the fjords. And of course, night boat. The crime-solving boat.
That doesn't really help. Pictures of them from above, you stupid fuckers. Ah, what's
Marge, it's night boat. The crime-solving boat.
Oh, so it's what I've been drawing anyway.
You've been drawing a crime-solving boat? I think I want to join this D&D game.